This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Sedaris has developed a passionate following for his funny autobiographical essays and his terrific readings. His greatest hit, so to speak, is his piece The Santaland Diaries, about the Christmas season he spent wearing an elf suit working in Macy's Santaland. It became a hit when he read the piece on NPR's Morning Edition. Sedaris is now a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life. His books Barrel Fever and Naked have been bestsellers. His new collection, Me Talk Pretty One Day, includes several pieces about his recent move to France, where he's been struggling to learn the language. The book is dedicated to his father, about who he says, "You wouldn't seek him out for advice on a personal problem, but he'd be the first one you'd call when the dishwasher broke or someone flushed a hairpiece down your toilet." David's father is also a jazz fan, and he encouraged his kids to take music lessons. Although David's only music ambition was to be a song stylist like Billie Holiday, he briefly took guitar lessons from a midget named Mr. Mancini. Here's an excerpt of his guitar lessons piece. He's just confessed to his teacher that he hasn't practiced.
My voice shaking, I told him that I had absolutely no interest in mastering the guitar. What I really wanted was to sing in the voice of Billie Holiday. Mainly commercials, but not for banks or car dealerships, because those are usually choral arrangements. The color ebbed from my teacher's face. I told him I'd been working up an act and could use a little accompaniment. Did he know the jingle for the new Sara Lee campaign? You want me to do what? He wasn't angry, just confused. I felt certain he was lying when he denied knowing the tune. Double Mint Gum, Ritz Crackers, the theme songs for Alka-Seltzer and Kenmore Appliances. He claimed ignorance on all counts. I knew that it was queer to sing in front of someone, but greater than my discomfort was the hope that he might recognize what I thought of as my great talent, the one musical trick I was able to pull off. I started in on an a cappella version of the latest Oscar Mayer commercial, hoping he might join in once the spirit moved him. It looked bad, I knew, but in order to sustain the proper mood, I needed to disregard his company and sing the way I did at home alone in my bedroom, my eyes shut tight and my hands dangling like pointless, empty gloves. I sang that my baloney had a first name. I added that my baloney had a second name and concluded with, "Oh, I love to eat it every day. And if you ask me why, I'll say that Oscar Mayer has a way with B-O-L-O-G-N-A. I reached the end of my tune thinking he might take this as an opportunity to applaud or maybe even apologize for underestimating me. Mild amusement might have been an appropriate response, but instead he held up his hands as if to stop an advancing car. "Hey, guy," he said, "you can hold it right there. I'm not into that scene." A scene? What scene? I thought I was being original. "There were plenty of screwballs like you back in Atlanta," he said. "But me, I don't swing that way. You got it? This might be your thing or whatever, but you can definitely count me out." He reached for his conch shell and stubbed out his cigarette. "I mean, come on now. For God's sakes, kid, pull yourself together." I knew then why I'd never sung in front of anyone, and why I shouldn't have done it in front of Mr. Mancini. He'd used the word screwball, but I knew what he really meant. He meant I should have named my guitar Doug or Brian, or better yet, taken up the flute. He meant that if we're defined by our desires, I was in for a lifetime of trouble.
And that's David Sedaris reading from his new collection, Me Talk Pretty One Day. David, you know, I love that story, and I had to have you read it so that you could do your Billie Holiday thing. You know, reading that made me wonder if there was a lot you had to hide as a kid because you were gay and it wasn't a good thing to let people know that.
Well, it was pretty much the last thing that you wanted to be if you were, I don't know, growing up that time in North Carolina, or maybe it's still that way for kids growing up today, is that you just think it'll change tomorrow. I'm just this way today, but tomorrow it will change, and that it has to be your secret. But what's so funny is then you look back and you see in family photographs, or I should have just had the word queen tattooed on my forehead. I wasn't fooling anybody. Anybody. You don't wear your mother's pantyhose and think that your parents are going to mistake you for heterosexual, but at that time you think, oh, I'm clever, and that they'll never know.
So did cover-ups and lying become necessary and commonplace in your life when you were young?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, you had to hide what it was that you were really doing and what you were really thinking. But the thing is, in my family, I probably didn't need to hide it at all. I think that because I wasn't fooling anybody, I don't think that they would have really had any sort of a problem with it.
But the outside world might have.
The outside world, yeah. But my mother was kind of one of those people that if you could buy a kit and how to make your child a homosexual, she would have bought that kit. Because it means your child's not going to be a juvenile delinquent and that they're going to wind up, you know, probably, you know, spending some money on your Mother's Day present and be a good... I mean, if your son is gay, you don't really worry about him. Oh, you certainly don't worry about him, like, marrying a woman who you're not going to like, but you don't worry about him getting into trouble.
If covering up became a kind of part of your personality, or if it became a part of your art too, or if it gave you liberty to play it fast and loose with the truth sometimes in the art, in the writing.
I think I'm just very comfortable with that. I'm very comfortable at, I don't know, lying would be the word, but exaggerating.
Uh-huh.
I'm very That sounds like such a modern thing to say, doesn't it? I'm very comfortable with exaggeration. What that means is that I'm a liar, and I always have been.
Are you saying you're a liar and you've always have been?
Yes, I've always been a liar. I still am one now, and nothing irritates me more than somebody calling me a liar. You know, like if somebody called me an Eskimo, I wouldn't really care because I'm not an Eskimo, but there's nothing more irritating than being called what it is that you really are. And I've just noticed that over the years. When people call me a liar, I get so angry that I can't control myself. So it must be true.
But this is a handy thing to have for fiction, isn't it? I mean, to be able to take something kind of boring that happened and make it into something really interesting.
Yes, and that was that was sort of my challenge with the stories in this new book, is to try to exaggerate less and to try to work with the truth and try to make the truth as interesting as I possibly could and fight my natural inclination, which was to lie.
Why did you want to do that in these stories? I mean, is that something you hadn't done in previous stories?
I just looked at it as an assignment, and I thought, well, if I was going to try to make this book a little bit different, maybe that would just be an assignment that I would give to myself. Because certain things are, you know, fairly anticlimactic.
Mm-hmm.
So I just fought my impulse to embroider those things and thought, well, this is my homework. This is my assignment, is to restrict myself to the truth.
I mean, on the whole, do you find daily life boring or interesting? Because, like, daily life, when it's interpreted in your fiction, always becomes really interesting and really funny, full of lots of perceptions. But a lot of times, daily life is really pretty tedious.
Yeah, I just feel like I'm lucky whenever I find evidence to the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
I left Paris yesterday morning, and I was waiting at the taxi. I went to the taxi stand to get a cab to the airport, and there was a fire truck there. And in Paris, you call the firemen instead of calling the ambulance. And the firemen were administering to this woman who appeared to be in her mid-30s. I don't know what her problem was, but they gave her some aspirin, and it's powdered aspirin there mixed with water, and they served it to her in a goblet. It was a glass goblet, not a paper cup, but a goblet that they had in their fire truck. So they're driving around the city of Paris with goblets in their fire truck. And I see a thing like that, and that's just plain interesting to me. That's just great. I love it when something like that happens. But, you know, most days you don't see anything that good, so you just have to exaggerate.
Getting back to the idea of exaggeration or lying or whatever it is, do friends or family ever feel betrayed when you have toyed with the truth?
They feel more betrayed when I have not toyed with the truth. They feel more betrayed when I'm telling the truth and the truth involves them. If I exaggerate about them, then they have less of a problem with it.
Oh, because you're not really betraying what happened. You're You're giving this
right.
a different version, so you're not really telling the secrets.
Right. But I'm just very fortunate to come from a family of good sports, and they don't, you know, if there's something they don't want me to write about, they'll preface it by saying, you cannot write about this.
Right.
But other than that, they really don't have a problem with it. Like, you know, I'll say to my dad, well, it's not really you. You know, it's someone who looks just like you and says the exact same things that you said and lives in your house and speaks in your voice, but it's not you. It's just an idea of you. And he said, yeah, okay, which is just amazing. I didn't know that he could be talked into things that easily. He's just a very good, all of my family, they're good sports that way. But I do have to think about them. Like when I write about myself, I have to, like I write about myself every day in my diary, and that is me. But in order to write a story, then I have to think of myself as a character. And that doesn't mean that I have to necessarily lie or exaggerate, but if I'm going to be in a story, then I have to think of myself as a character. And then I think of my family as characters, too, when I write about them. Not when I talk to them on the phone, but when I write about them, I do.
Now do you see yourself differently in real life because you've made yourself into a character in your stories? I mean, do you see things about yourself that you maybe only would have noticed by turning yourself into a character?
Yes. When I write about myself as a character, I look at every horrible thing about myself and I concentrate on that.
Why?
Much more than I would in real life. Because I don't think it really works to say horrible things about other people unless you're going to really be hard on yourself.
Uh-huh.
Because otherwise people read it and then it's like, oh, poor him. You know, oh, everyone's unfair. Everyone's being so mean to him. And it just doesn't work. So if I acknowledge just what a shallow, pretentious jerk I am and keep my finger on that, then I can still say horrible things about other people, but it's understood that I'm worse than they are, which I genuinely believe that I'm worse than just about anybody who's not in prison.
One of the stories in your new collection, Me Talk Pretty One Day, is about your earlier life before you were a writer as a conceptual artist and performance artist. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that story.
Sure. The story is called 12 Moments in the Life of the Artist, and it's split into 12 different chapters. And this is the fifth chapter. 5. My sister Gretchen was leaving for the Rhode Island School of Design just as I was settling back into Raleigh. After a few months in my parents' basement, I took an apartment near the State University where I discovered both crystal methamphetamine and conceptual art. Either one of these things is dangerous, but in combination they have the potential to destroy entire civilizations. The moment I took my first burning snootful, I understood that this was a drug for me. Speed eliminates all doubt. Am I smart enough? Will people like me? Do I really look all right in this plastic jumpsuit? These are questions for insecure potheads. A speed enthusiast knows that everything he says or does is brilliant. The upswing is that, having eliminated the need for both eating and sleeping, you have a full 24 hours a day to spread your charm and talent. For God's sakes, my father would say, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. What are you calling for? I was calling because the rest of my friends had taken to unplugging their phones after 10 p.m. These were people I'd known in high school, and it disappointed me to see how little we now had in common. They were still talking about pen and ink portraits and couldn't understand my desire to drag a heavy cash register through the forest. I hadn't actually done it, but it sounded like a good idea to me. These people were all stuck in the past, setting up their booths in the art fair and thinking themselves successful because they'd sold a silk screen of a footprint in the sand. It was sad in a way. Here they were, struggling to make art, while without the least bit of effort, I was living art. My socks balled up on the hardwood floor made a greater statement than any of their hokey claptrap with the carefully matted frames and big curly signatures in the lower left-hand corners. Didn't they read any of the magazines? The new breed of artists wanted nothing to do with my sister's idea of beauty. Here were people who made a living pitching tents or lying in a fetal position before our national monuments. One fellow had made a name for himself by allowing a friend to shoot him in the shoulder. This was the art world I'd been dreaming of, where God-given talent was considered an unfair advantage, and a cold-blooded stare merited more praise than the ability to render human flesh. Everything around me was art, from the stains in my bathtub to the razor blade and short length of drinking straw I used to ingest and cut my speed. I was back in the world with a clear head and a keen vision of just how talented I really was.
David, is there a piece that you did during that period that you could describe for us?
You know, the thing is, my performance art was just so vacant and just so formulaic. Like, if I talk about plays that I've done, I can recall them because the plays had a story. But this was like the worst sort of performance art because it told no story whatsoever. It was all prop driven. It was that sort of thing where you bring out like 15 objects and the audience just sits there and waits while you go through the rubber boot and while you go through the inflatable shark and while you go through the aspirin bottle filled with BBs. And the part of what made it so horrible was this notion that it was the audience's job to figure out the meaning. It wasn't your job. Your job was to just get up there with a sort of a slack expression on your face and, I don't know, cut your hair with garden shears. That was all you really needed to do. And I think it was something I read about in a magazine. You know, I just saw, oh, you can be an artist and you don't really have, you can do the same things you do at home. You just invite people to come and watch you. And so I did that for a couple of years, and I look back and, gee, I'm so embarrassed over some of the things that I did. And of course, I was just high as I could be the entire time, which convinced me that what I was doing was actually brilliant.
But as embarrassed as you are about the pieces that you did then, I bet there was something really liberating in a good way about your conceptual art and performance art period.
No, there was nothing liberating about it. It was just torment, and I just tortured everybody around me. Everybody around me, and forcing my family to come and watch me in these horrible, horrible spectacles. And it wasn't really until I dropped out of college, and I was living in Raleigh when I discovered speed and conceptual art. And then I went back to school when I was 27. And then I was in art school, and I would watch people do these performances. And then I was able to really sort of clearly see for the first time just how unfun it is to sit in the audience, because it's all just about you being a performer. You don't really think about people in the audience. With a play, you think about people in the audience, and you think, are they going to get this story? Are they going to be bored? Are they going to walk out? And you sort of tailor what you're doing to those concerns. Whereas with performance art, you could just convince yourself that if people didn't get it, they were stupid. And you would think, well, who wouldn't want to watch me take a nap? who wouldn't want to see that?
So what was the actual turning point when you decided to give up your performance art?
When I ran out, my drug dealer moved to another state, and I did not have any speed left. And it was all I could do just to really to get out of bed. I've always been fond of drugs, but I don't think I'd ever been really hooked on anything before. And you don't really know you're hooked until you don't get your drugs anymore, and then you go through a withdrawal. And it was, I think, coming through the withdrawal from that, I thought, well, that part of my life is over. It's completely over, and it's time to try something new.
Is that when you started writing, or were you already writing?
I was already writing, and then I just sort of moved into that more or less full time, into the writing, rather than into the... Well, I went on to go to art school, but when I was in art school, it was mainly for painting and for sculpture, and I didn't do any performance art while I was in school.
How much talent did you have for, say, representational painting and sculpture?
I have no talent whatsoever. No talent whatsoever. If I was a courtroom sketch artist, it would look like drawings of a five-year-old. All the characters would have really big heads, and they would either smile or frown. It would be like those drawings that children do after they've been abused or whatever, with the angry mommy or the happy mommy. They would be drawings like that. I can't draw. No, I can't draw anything.
Why did you want to be an artist if you felt you had so little talent for it?
I wanted to be an artist just from when I was young and reading books and biographies, and I had the idea that you would be an artist and it would just be very romantic and you would live in a garret and you would have a closet full of berets. And it was just a life, some goofy romantic notion that I had picked up when I was young. And it was enough to keep me going until the age of 28, this romantic notion.
So what you wanted was the artist's life, maybe more so than the art itself?
I wanted the artist life, and I wanted to live in a studio and filled with naked men, you know, who would be posing for me. I would chisel them out of marble. And then I saw myself, like, wearing long scarves and going to museum openings. But I just could never see the work itself. That was a problem.
So when you took writing more seriously and gave up painting and sculpture and performance art, did you fashion a kind of artist life for yourself as a writer? Did you see the possibilities for that?
No, strangely, I never did. But with writing, I would just notice how, when I was doing artwork, how I could look at something and walk away from it and just forget it. Whereas there would be certain stories that I would read that I would be haunted by, and I would read them over and over and over again until I memorized them. And I just noticed that the words had power over me, whereas visual art genuinely didn't. So no, I never, that's not why I got into it. I think I just got into it because nothing else worked. I tried being an actor, I was horrible. I tried performance art, I stunk. I tried visual art, I was terrible. I'm just lucky I found writing before I went through a dance phase.
The funny thing is, though, that there is a whole romance around writing, just as there is a whole romance around the life of the visual artist. And I'm surprised kind of that you didn't hook into that romanticized vision of the writer.
No, I guess because I've always read a lot of biographies, and you always just read about writers wind up, you know, they wind up being really drunk and calling their friends until their friends don't answer the phone. Like Jean Stafford, she was one of those writers who wound up just a mess. And her last project, she had an idea for a book called Cooking for One While Drunk. So I never thought of a rosy ending to a writing life. But then I look and I think, okay, well, I live in Paris, and I have some books, and you know, I get to go on a book tour, and from the outside, I think, gosh, that looks okay. You know, that looks pretty good, but it's not. You know, it's just work.
Uh huh. Now you said that crystal methamphetamine was your drug of choice because it was so good at eliminating doubts and make you feeling really confident and good about yourself and your work. What were some of the doubts you needed to eliminate that were very inhibiting for you?
That I had no talent whatsoever, and that what I was doing was absolutely meaningless, and that everybody was laughing at me instead of admiring me because I came up with these great things that they couldn't understand. Speed pretty much eliminates any doubt that you would have. You know, you look like a million bucks, you're incredibly bright. I look back at my diary during that time, and I would easily write 10 pages a night. And it's just awful, just awful. There's not a single sentence in there worth salvaging. And then if that's what I wrote down, when I think what came out of my mouth was probably even worse.
When you stopped taking speed, did the old doubts come back, the doubts that you were suppressing with the speed?
Oh, yes, they came back. Oh, they came back immediately, only stronger.
Well, how did you deal with those doubts in your writing?
With the writing, it seems much easier to deal with those doubts because you can confront them honestly. And also, you're telling a story. If I'm telling a story, there's something I can work with. But if I'm not telling a story, and if I'm just, if I'm using a hammer to crack open a boiled egg, that's not really telling any kind of a story. There's no narrative thing there. There's no real meaning to it. And I don't know how do you convey doubt while you're doing that without saying anything? How do you convey doubt while you're cracking open a boiled egg? Whereas on paper or out loud, you can do that. I don't know, there was something about that whole period where narrative was bad. Narrative was a bad thing. To tell people a story was cheap and easy.
So it was just... Like when you started writing, was there a kind of experimental fiction that was the equivalent of performance art?
Yes, but I noticed I never read those things.
Right.
Those are
right.
the things that I would read a couple lines and I would just skip over. I didn't want that. I wanted to be told a story. And so, I didn't feel any... You know, like sometimes you're young and you go through a certain phase and you pretend to like these things that you can't bear. You pretend to like these movies that are just, in fact, they're just a bore. But you think that if you say that they're boring, then everyone's going to think you're stupid. But I noticed that I would never subject myself to reading things that didn't have the story, that didn't satisfy me. And I felt okay in saying, that's not for me. And so luckily I never went through that phase.
So the doubts that came back after you stopped the crystal meth and started writing, it sounds like those are doubts that you were able to incorporate into the writing, that you were in part writing about the doubts so you could describe them instead of suppressing them?
Yes, and they were very helpful that way. Because really, that's basically all I have to talk about is my doubts. And denied that, gee, you just pour styrofoam pellets into a rubber boot and empty them into a pail and call it a night.
You're living in France. How long have you been there?
I've been there for as almost 2 years.
Uh-huh. And what brought you to France? Why did you leave New York?
Smoking. You can smoke wherever you want to in France. And it's heaven that way. All those European countries... They should just represent them on maps with big ashtrays. I recorded a book on tape in New York, my last book. I recorded it on tape here, and you had to leave the building. You had to go down 8 floors in order to have a cigarette. And I recorded the new book on tape in Paris, and there were 2 standing ashtrays right in the recording booth, which was the size of a closet. And then beyond the glass wall in the engineer's area, I lost track of the ashtrays. It was like looking at a thick fog, and every now and then, I would see the director wave her arms. I chose my bank because it had the biggest ashtray.
Let me stop you. How does your boyfriend Hugh feel about you smoking in the house in Paris? Because I don't think he liked it particularly in New York. So just because everybody else smokes in Paris, what about in your house?
He has no problem with it in Paris. But in New York, our apartment, we used to call it the trailer in the sky because it looked like it looked like a double-wide trailer. And the ceiling was about that high. And in Paris, the ceilings are really tall and there's huge windows, so he never says a word about it there.
What's it like for you, who is so verbal and so defined by your language, to function in a country where you can't do what most defines you, which is speak? I mean, I think your French is probably still fairly rudimentary, and so it's hard, I'm sure, for you to communicate with a lot of the people there.
That's my incentive, though, to learn, because, you know, it drives me crazy to sit there and have to keep my mouth shut. It drives me absolutely out of my mind. So that's been my biggest incentive to learn. I talk like Yoda, basically. And now my verbs are, I'm getting my verbs down. And that makes it a lot easier, because you can't, some exhaust people a little bit less than I did before. I just try to be the most cheerful person in the country. That's how I go about it. And just try to have a really good attitude. And I'm Mr. Polite. But it's hard. You know, we'll go to dinner sometimes, and he speaks French perfectly, and he's got a lot of French friends. And we'll go to dinner at their house, and at one end of the table, everybody is laughing and engaging in sparkling conversation. And I just see the guests at my end of the table saying, I had to sit next to him the last time. Everyone on the other side of the table, they're having a ball. And on my end of the table, it's me saying, I saw a rabbit in the road yesterday, and he was happy. That's what I have to bring to the table.
Well, David Sedaris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Sedaris has a new book. It's called Me Talk Pretty One Day.